So, as we were dealing with last class, there was a huge consequence of the development of mercantilism thanks to Italy, and that was a demand, an insatiable demand for all of the fancy things that came through global trade. But, because of me dropping the mouse and bouncing ahead, wicked far, bum, 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 the political winds of the 15th century changed significantly, and that greatly curtailed the ability of the West to get the goods from the East. So, two nations, both that happened to inhabit the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, were the first two nations to contemplate going from here to here by getting around all of this. Not an easy thing to do. The reason being was knowledge. Knowledge. What did Europe know about the world? Well, they knew what was in their neck of the woods. They knew all about the Mediterranean. And they knew that if you go east enough, you'll get to the foreign lands of China and India. They knew about Africa because it was just on the other side of the Mediterranean. But you know what they did not know? They didn't know how big it was. They also didn't know what was up here, other than it was freaking cold. And they knew eventually, if we tried going around Europe by going to north, we'd get close to Russia, and Russia was the bad guys. So it was a conundrum. We want to get from A to B. What do? Well, as it turns out, timing is everything. As the old saying goes, timing is everything. And the first nation to take the leap, just in terms of just a few decades, was the Portuguese. Portugal decided the easiest, cheapest, quickest way to get to Asia would be to go around Africa. Why? Well, as it turned out, the Portuguese had ancient texts, books that were thousands of years old, and seemed to imply that an ancient people called the Phoenicians did it once. You know who the Phoenicians are? Again, Epcot. You go into Epcot, the Phoenicians were the one who wrote the phonetic alphabet. Took all of the different spoken languages of the ancient world and gave them universal characters that people could read based on the sounds that make up each word. Well, the Phoenicians were from the Middle East, and they were some of the ancient great explorers and traders during the Bronze Age. Well, there was a story about them going out of the Straits of Gibraltar and showing up in the Red Sea. So if they could do it, surely the Portuguese could do it. But again, this is about how far they knew. They didn't know how big it was. So how do you get that knowledge? Baby steps. In 1415, the third son of the King of Portugal, Prince Henry, knowing that he didn't want to go into the church, which was very common for third sons of kings, decided to go into business.
But of course, he didn't want to get on a boat and risk his life sailing halfway around the world. So he came up with a lucrative way that he could make money.
What he would do, he would sponsor expeditions. He'd buy the boat. He'd hire the crew. Hire the captain. And in return, he would get 20% of whatever was discovered. So that meant the captain and the crew could keep 80%. Pretty good deal. Pretty good deal. Well, Henry would be alive until 1460. So for 45 years, he kept paying for these expeditions. And what they began doing is they would start going out. They'd go a little further, record what they found, and came back. Go a little further, record what they found, and come back. Bit by bit by bit until Henry's death, and they were right about here, around where the Congo River is. Well, one of the most important things that were discovered was the existence of powerful African kingdoms that had rulers like kings, that had nobles like in Europe. And those powerful African kings wanted the same thing as the European kings. More, more, more. So the Portuguese made friendly contact with them. And in some instances, made trade deals with the Europeans, with the Portuguese, with very Portuguese stuff, in exchange for Africa.
Well, during the reign of Henry's nephew, John II, who became King of Portugal in the late 1470s, the Portuguese started it again. But this time, John used the crown's money. So the government bought the ships. The government hired the crew. The government hired the captain. But the deal was the same. The captain and crew would keep 80%, but the crown would get 20%.
Well, during his reign, after making peaceful contact with some of the chieftains, they were allowed to build a fortress in the modern country of Ghana. They sailed and explored a little bit up the Congo River, but the expedition south continued all the way up until 1488. When Bartolomeu Dias would come all the way down to the southernmost point of Africa, and he called it the Cape of Good Hope, because as he came around, the land, the coast, started going northerly, and he realized he got around the southern tip. Well, when Diaz returned to Lisbon and reported to John, of course, thanks to Venice, the Venetians and their development of embassies and ambassadors, every single kingdom in Europe had ambassadors in Lisbon. So they all heard the news. This was huge. This was epic. Because now, since 1453 and the conquest of Constantinople, now the Europeans had the ability to get the good stuff. It just take a while. A long boat ride.
But again, there's friendly, peaceful kingdoms along the way. You can make relations with them, and all is good. Well, the moment Diaz returned and word spread, other kings said, hey, I want in on this. And right next door to Portugal is Spain. They decided, well, if we also go south, that could potentially be, an act of war. Because the Portuguese have laid claims to open islands, and they've made friendly agreements with the powerful kingdoms. So if suddenly the Spanish came down, the Africans might kill them. So we can't go that way. We don't want to go north, because again, it's cold. And by the way, we're in the little ice age, so for the first time in recorded history, the North Pole and the Arctic, and the Arctic ice, is expanding massively. So if we can't go this way to get to here, and we can't go that way this way, there's only one way to go. West. Now, just like the Portuguese, who had ancient texts hinting that the Phoenicians got around Africa, the Spain were also aware of more recent texts that came from the people that we collectively call the Vikings. That in and around 1,000, that they crossed the Atlantic and discovered a new land. So the idea of going west was not horrific. It was not frightful. Oh, and by the way, the guy who brought the proposal to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, Christopher Columbus, he did not think the world was flat. That's a lie. Everybody at the time knew the world was round, going back to the ancient Greeks. Sadly, the story that Columbus, or everyone at the time, thought the world was flat, comes from misinformation, an outright fallacy, a lie, that was developed in 1828 by the first man in America to write a biography of Columbus, a guy by the name of Washington Irving, whose name you might not recognize, but maybe you've heard of the Headless Horseman, you know, the legend of Sleepy Hollow. How about Rip Van Winkle? Guy who, like, fell asleep and woke up 30 years later. Those are stories written by Washington Irving. But in his first book, A Biography of Columbus, it was he who claimed that everyone at the time thought that the earth was flat, trying to make the people of that age feel like they were intellectually superior. Just like our people that are in the modern times think that we are so much more intelligent than the people who lived centuries ago, which is, truth be told, not true by any means. But Columbus simply put two and two together. If the world is round, and I go this way, and we know we can go this way, and based on what the Vikings said, it's not that far. It's only a matter of time before I come up over here. Because that was the best knowledge of the day. So, Ferdinand and Isabella gives him a small fleet of 3 ships, and he sets sail. There's Ferdinand and Isabella, king and queen of Spain. Oh, by the way, prior to their marriage, Spain did not exist. Spain was 2 separate kingdoms, Aragon and Castile. Ferdinand was the king of Aragon, and Isabella was a princess of Castile. So when they married, that's what created the modern country of Spain, their union. But anyways, so he gets the petition, They give him a charter. The terms, I think the terms were more like 70-30. I don't remember the exact split. But it was the same basic system that the Portuguese used. That the king and queen would buy the boats, hire the crew, hire the captain, and they would get a cut of the return. Now, based on his calculations, Columbus believed he could get to a land called Chapagnu, which according to Marco Polo was Japan. He believed he could get there in 33 days, about 3.5 weeks. But here is the kicker. Nobody thought the world was flat. But sometimes we make mistakes based on the best information we have at hand, because information can be wrong. First mistake. In calculating the circumference of the earth, Columbus came up with an earth that was 25% smaller than its actual size. He was off about 5,300 miles. The reason being was that he used Persian miles. Persian miles. Are bigger than actual miles. A Persian mile is almost or a little over 7,000 feet, linear feet, whereas an actual mile is about 52. So he takes the degrees and he calculates the distance between the degrees on latitude, and he ends up with an earth, because the miles were bigger, with an earth being actually smaller than it was. Screwed up his math, big time. And his second critical mistake, he used Marco Polo's book as the basis for his calculations on how, again, this was his map. I mean, look how bloated and big Asia is. He based his map on estimates established by Marco Polo 200 years before him. So if you have the landmass that you're trying to get to on the other side being bigger, in fact, he moved it 8,000 miles closer to Europe. At the end of the day, when you put the two together, that's how he believed, oh, it's going to take me about 30 days to cross the water, and I'll end up over here. Now, of course, we know Columbus would come over 4 times. His first expedition launched in September 1792, and oddly enough, about 37 days later, he and his crew sighted land, which was the Bahamas, which he believed to be Japan. And over the next several years, he would make 4 journeys over to the New World. And he was absolutely convinced that he discovered Asia. Absolutely convinced. Ironically, he would die penniless. Because you know what he never found? Anything of value. Sure, he came across natives. Some of the most generous natives he came across were the Taino Indians on
San Salvador. But, sorry, it's my office. I'm not going to deal with them because I don't do it. Help me. What was I saying? Oh, San Salvador, the Tiano Indians. These natives were completely friendly to Columbus, and Columbus and his men were absolutely amazed. They gave his men anything they asked for. They gave them food. They gave them fresh water. Heck, they even gave them sexual favors. In his diaries, he recorded that the Tiano, and I quote, "they never say no to anything." Of course, he would bring 8 of them back to Spain as physical proof that they were actually Asians, because they match Marco Polo's description of the people who live in the subcontinent of India. Darker skin, darker hair, dark eyes. Had to be Indians. They had to be from India. Of course, the one thing that he and his crew did bring back, which was something that was not in Europe, the Indians gave the Spanish the clap. No reaction? You get it. Syphilis. They shared syphilis. All right, but anyways, as I was saying, competition, competition, competition. Now you have the Portuguese going one way, racing to Africa, around Africa to Asia. Now you have the Spanish believing that they found Asia. You have a competition that is unfolding, and you have the realistic possibility of warfare. Because now you have two powers believing they're going to the same place at the same time, trying to get more. Well, ironically, in one of the last power plays by the church, the church managed to get the rulers from both kingdoms to sit down and to make an agreement. None other than the Borgia Pope. The corrupt Pope that wanted to take a kingdom for his son and betrayed the other Italian states. Alexander VI. Alexander VI managed to get John, King of Portugal, and Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain to sit down and to make an agreement that would prevent warfare between these two powerful kingdoms. This treaty is the Treaty of Tordesillas. Under the Treaty of Tordesillas, the Pope literally took a globe and drew an imaginary line on it. The line, of course, was based on the best knowledge that he had at the time. At 39 degrees, 53 minutes west latitude, the Pope drew the imaginary line around the earth and basically said everything on the eastern side of the line, this is Portugal's. All this territory over here is Portugal's. Why? Because Portugal already went that way. So that's theirs. But everything on the west side of the line, going all the way to the other side of the earth, would be Spain's by right. Because after all, according to Columbus, Spain did get to Japan and saw the coast of China and possibly India. So, to prevent war, this is Portugal's, this is Spain's. And thus would set the next 100 years of explorations.
Both sides knew the zones that they could go to. Both sides did. And he managed to actually avoid war between the two mercantile empires. Questions? All right. No, no, you good? Okay. But here's the funny thing. Both empires would actually go literally and proverbially, they'd take different paths to achieve the same results. More, more, more. More money, more land, more power. We're going to do Spain first. Spain would, when they arrived in the New World, set out to literally take the land, to conquer it, to establish domain, to establish empire over the world that Columbus gave to them. And they would do it sequentially. They didn't do it all at once. The conquest would take place over several decades, beginning with Columbus establishing a base of operations in Hispaniola, the first significant inhabited island he discovered. Well, on his second expedition, he set up the settlement that would become the launching pad for the conquests. What two nations are in Hispaniola? No clue. Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Well, from this, they would begin conquering some of the minor islands, but really didn't discover much. They would begin, you know, going north. They would explore Florida. But the next big seizure of territory and occupation was Cuba. Cuba would become a Spanish colony, which meant Spaniards began coming over and making homesteads. And then as they extended their control over the Caribbean, eventually 1519, they would sail out and they would land in the Yucatan Peninsula. And the more they went, the more they explored, the more they came in contact with the people here, the more questions began to arise. None of the things that we're finding match in any way, shape, or form what Marco Polo says in his book. There are no great walled cities like he described in China. There is no deserts. There's no grand caravans of merchants. There's no, well, there were weird religions with multiple gods, but nothing like the Hindus or Buddhists or anything like that. There was nothing. There was other things, but nothing like was described. So after about 20-odd years of conquest and colonization, Spaniards really began questioning, where are we? What is this place? Are we really in Asia? Well, in 1520, another explorer sailing under the Spanish flag, Ferdinand Magellan, he put that to bed. 1520. Magellan would depart from Spain. He had 5 ships. He had 235 men. And he was instructed to go figure out what the hell did we get out of the Treaty of Tordesillas. So he would attempt to find if this was Asia, and if it was not, where on earth is Asia? began by sailing down. He followed the coastline of South America, which was known about at that time. And he continued going south until he would round Cape Horn, realizing kind of how big this thing was. Then he began sailing north, and he realized, okay, this is not an island. This is, in fact, a continent. And there's another big ocean. So, being curious, and he's also instructed to go find Asia, he filled up with fresh water, fresh food, fresh supplies, and then launched out into the Pacific. Of course, he did touch upon some of the smaller Pacific islands, so they were always constantly able to get like fresh water and some foodstuffs. But eventually, he made his way and believed to have landed in the Philippines. And in the Philippines, he made a mistake. Because the Spaniards also brought with them Jesuits and the cross. So, Magellan, April 29th, 1521, is sitting down having a conversation with the chief of a people called the Datu. The chief's name was Lapu Lapu. Lapu Lapu of the Datu. Tried converting him to Christianity. Well, Lapu Lapu would have none of it. He called his men on the warpath. Magellan and his few men that he had left quickly picked up whatever they could, ran down to the beach, got into the rowboats, started going ashore. But as Magellan was getting to get ready into the boat, he got struck in the back with a poison-laden arrow. As he starts getting weak, he tells his men, row for your lives, row for your lives. And he would make a last stand. Well, the last documented account of Magellan, made by his men, said a bunch of the natives descended upon him, clubbed him like a baby seal, and began hacking his body up to bits. Because much to the horror of Magellan's men, the Datu were cannibals. So Magellan became lunch. Eventually, after more death, horror, destruction, eventually, one of the five ships, with just 18 men, managed to limp its way back to Spain. And in 1521, all the world knew definitively that Columbus was wrong. This was not Asia. It was something new. But the best part for the Spaniards, going back to the Crusades and Terra Nullius, this vast land was not the land of Christians. And under the laws of the church, what can Christians do under Terra Nullius? Why?
Because it's their
land. Right, because what are the people who are currently occupying the lands not?
Not Christians.
They're not Christians. And under the laws of the church, Christians have a right to take land, property, from non-Christians. So that's what the Spaniards set out to do. Because what did the rulers of Spain want? More, more, more. And by the way, the most amazing thing isn't the fact that the Spanish was able to conquer it, but rather how weak and pathetic the natives were. Completely weak and pathetic. They were rolled over. Now, hold on. I'll tell you why. The Aztec population in 1520, estimated to be 20 million. But Hernando Cortez comes in with 630 men, and he conquered them. Completely conquered. Knocked them over. Rolled them over. The vast Aztec Empire, 20 million people, conquered by 630. And then just two decades later, Pizarro conquered the Inca, population of around 13 million, with just 180 men. It's baffling. It's baffling. I would love it if I could get a small detachment of 200 guys going and conquering a country of 20 million. That would be awesome. But truth be told, if you ever have opportunities to dig into the stories, it's not as simple as I'm making it. Truth be told, both empires were new. Both the Aztec and the Inca empires were no more than 100 years old. And the vast majority of the people that were part of the empire hated their rulers. So one of the most brilliant things that the Spaniards did is they played the role of liberator to the conquered people, which caused them to join with the Spaniards and overthrow the leadership. Of course, the one thing they didn't realize is that once the Aztec were toppled and the Inca were toppled, the Spaniards would put the King of Spain in the place and would seek to rule over the natives. Oh, the other thing that I should mention, because I'm always fair, is that by the time the conquest was complete, it wasn't the armor. It wasn't that the natives thought that these guys were gods. Heck, it wasn't even the boom boom sticks, the primitive arquebuses that they brought with them, firearms. It wasn't that which helped them win. It was the fact that the people of the day had no idea of the impact of spreading pandemics. They didn't understand disease. They didn't understand how it spread. The Spaniards, I'm not going to call them Europeans, the Spaniards brought over with them over their successive journeys, brought with them about 30 significant diseases, which were not native to this part of the world. So when a native came in contact with a Spaniard who might be carrying the flu or smallpox or any other myriad of diseases, the natives had no natural resistance to it. While there were some isolated islands in the Caribbean that were reported in a generation to become completely wiped out, the average that modern historians believe was that densely populated regions of the New World were just decimated by diseases, with death rates ranging anywhere between 30 and 90%. So, the aforementioned 20 million people that were in the Aztec Empire in 1500, by 1600, dropped down to about 2 million. Inca population, about 13, dropped down to 2 million. So while the natives did give venereal diseases to the Spaniards, this was the real reason why the natives just could not fight back. If you're exposed to something that you've never been exposed to, you're going to die. And the worst part is they didn't know where it was coming from. Kind of like what happened in Europe with the bubonic plague. Medical science was just not there. But for the natives, when they saw the arrival of a Spaniard and then suddenly a village is dead, In many ways, that was proof that the Spaniards' God was more powerful than their own. So we must submit. And in submission, this allowed Spain to make colonial empire. Ironically, in creating their empire, they used what was already there. Both the Aztec and the Inca empires were based on top-down rule. The monarch, the one guy at the top, had all power of everybody down below. That's what the Spaniards would do. Except instead of Montezuma and last ruler of the Inca. Tupac was the great conqueror. I can't remember the last Inca ruler. But you take off those local rulers, and what the Spaniards announced to these people is now their king is their great chief. But in Europe, they made it a bureaucracy, a bureaucratic structure. The king of Spain was the absolute ruler, both in Spain, in the Caribbean, Central and South America. He ruled over his dominion. But because the king had no idea what the heck was over here, he would actually create a special council, which was called the Council of Indies. Their job was simple: make money. Figure out how to use that land to make money. Because if they can make money out of this, then the king can become more powerful. Most of the men who sat on this were either merchants or nobles. But some of them actually took the time to travel over to the New World and see what was here with their own eyes. But to ensure the will of the king was enforced, what the Spaniards decided to do was to take their conquests and divide it up into three separate colonies, which they called viceroyalities. And in charge of each viceroyality was a viceroy, a governor, who was the king's hand. There was one that took control over the Caribbean that sat in Hispaniola. There was one that sat in Tenochtitlan, the former capital of the Aztec Empire, which of course was destroyed. The lake was filled in, and that's where Mexico City is today. And of course, in Lima, Peru, would be the capital of the third viceroy or viceroyality. The viceroy would rule his zone and ensure money was generated. But, one guy can't rule over such a zone. So what they did is they further subdivided. Each viceroyality was made up of several, what the Spaniards called, audiencias. Audiencias, which basically we could consider them like courts or jurisdictions. The job of the audiencia was to make sure that the law was obeyed. So the judges, the odiors, would hear complaints, cases. And instead of there being violence, the judge would make a ruling. One of the most fascinating elements of this was that if a native was mistreated, they could file a claim before the judge. And the judge would render justice. So So in addition to these courts, there were also municipal governments. In charge of the provinces were, I guess we would call them governors, but the Spaniard refers to the provinces, which was the land in between cities, as gobernaciones. Their job was to rule over all of the land in between the major cities to make sure there was governance in the wild, if you will. And in the cities, there were city councils that were made, cabildos, whose job was just like the government in Worcester, to make sure that the laws of the city are followed. Each one of these positions, however, would be filled with someone from Spain. And they were not allowed to make laws. They had to obey the laws that came down to them from the top. This system would completely erase the governments of the former empires that were erased. But why did the natives obey? Well, the Spaniards were aided by the Catholic Church. Typically, priests followed the footsteps of the conquistadors, the conquering explorers. Sometimes they were in the parties themselves. And what did they bring with them? Jesus! Fresh off the heels of the Reconquista, the purging Spain of Islam and the Jewish faith, these Spanish priests launch a crusade of sorts to save the souls of these heathens. They wanted to eliminate the religion as well as the culture of the natives and impose upon them the religion and culture of the church. And by the way, talk about no resistance. Ever meet anyone from Central America or from South America? Chances are, what language do they speak? Oh yeah, Spanish. And what religion are they? Chances are, Catholic. So 500 years later, these priests, completely successful. They implemented what we would call a cultural genocide. Completely eradicating. Eradicating. The Aztec culture, the Inca culture, the cultures of the natives. Gone. Gone. So, the system was a European system made to rule over God-fearing Catholics, and that's essentially what would happen in the New World. But when you dig into it, one of the weird things about it was that the church was not involved. It wasn't the Catholic Church. It wasn't Rome telling the priests to do this. No, the church was a tool of the crown. The Spanish priests acted for the king. Which again is the reason why they became Spanish speaking as opposed to merely Catholics. And man, did they go at it. They were all fired up. Because they were in competition with the Protestants, the Lutherans. Because Europe, we're not going to talk about it, at the same time was divided. Northern Europe was becoming Protestant and Southern Europe was staying Catholic. So these Catholics wanted to win the head count. And they were absolutely brutal. They ordered the destruction of temples and statues and monuments and books. Anything that referenced the past was destroyed. Oh, by the way, why does one want to destroy the history of another? What is the sole purpose?
So it's forgotten.
It's forgotten. Because what do young people know about history? Nothing. So you don't have to worry about that. It's the older people that remember. Well, what always happens to the older people? They die. And who's left in their place? So if you can wipe out the history, it's going to just take a generation. Because the young people, if they're taught different things, will never know actual history. They won't care. All they'll know is what is today. Kind of like you guys.
It's always done with a purpose. Politics. So, the priests made sure to destroy the history, leaving them with only Spanish culture, Catholic religion, and that's what they embraced. And it was quick. It was quick.
The Catholic priests report that usually within 5 to 10 years of a region being conquered, the vast majority of the population is converted.
So it wasn't even like it was a lingering struggle. The Spanish won on all accounts. Question. Right. Why did they do it? Money.
The economic system that would be imposed over the New World was referred to by the Spanish as the encomienda,
which roughly translates to tribute. Tribute. Because the crown wanted money above all else, the primary job of the viceroys and the governors and the gubernaciones and the city councils in the cabalitos was to make sure that wealth was being generated and shipped back to the New World. On a local level,
because the natives had no right to own land, because of terra nullius, the king would give personal land grants to Spanish nobles. They would take a map, draw a circle, and say, this is your property. The Spaniard would get on a boat, cross the Atlantic, come over and take possession of the plot. And then the moment he was here, he would try to figure out something that he could raise or dig or take possession of that could be put on a boat and shipped across the Atlantic.
Now, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon your perspective, when the Spanish came over, this land grant gave them the right to not only take tribute, to take stuff, it also gave them control over the natives that lived there. The natives would be expected to work and pay the landlord for the right to continue to live. Now, by the way, this extraction was exactly what the Aztec and the Incas did to the natives that they conquered. So in the eyes of the people that were controlled by the Aztecs, okay, they used to grow tobacco or sugar or coffee. The Spanish come in and they're still growing tobacco or coffee or sugar.
It's just a matter of who am I going to give my basket of goods to? The Aztec are gone, so I'm not going to give them my tribute. I'll give it to the Spanish. Now, don't think of this as being slaves. Not slaves. The Spanish landlords had a right to take possession of the people, but he didn't own the people. And the reason is fascinating. Back when Columbus set sail for his second expedition, and for every Spanish expedition that followed, while she was still alive, Queen Isabella herself made it a law that the natives were not to be considered property so long as they converted to the faith. So if a native converted and became a Catholic, he would be treated like a peasant, like the peasants in Europe, but not a slave. So they were free people. They just had to work for the system. So, as I'm slowly adding more and more facts to the narrative, why do you think so many natives quickly converted? Well, they didn't want to be a slave, so sure, I'll change my religion. If changing my religion means freedom, sign me up. Oh, and there was a way to get out of even that. Under Spanish law, any person who had a drop of Spanish blood in them, just a drop, was not required to contribute to the encomienda. So guess what natives did with their daughters?
Gave
them to the Spanish. Because the Spanish didn't bring women over with them. And then guess what happened to those mixed-race babies? They were treated as full citizens of Spain. And again, that's the reason why just about everybody from Central, South America, and the Caribbean are mixed race. Because of what the Spaniards did. And we can't affix morality to this. This had nothing to do with morals. This is nothing about ethics. This is all about making money. If you, as a Spanish male, were willing to get on a boat and come over here and get a land grant and work the land, sleep with some lovely native women, produce nice, beautiful mixed-race babies, you had the ability to make tremendous wealth. More wealth than you could living in Spain. Because the sky was the limit here. And so nobody here was worried about morality. No, 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 no. It was about making money. Revenue would come from one of two sources. The first would come through the exploitation of an Inca system called Mita. The Aztecs allowed the subjugated peoples to stay on their lands and to produce whatever it was their family had always produced. They just had to pay like taxes to the Aztec. The Inca taxation was in the form of labor. So instead of working your farm and giving it to the Inca, no, no, no. The Inca took you and put you in some area that produced something for the realm. The most common form was mining. There were mines that were in operation when the Spaniards came down because for the 100 years that the Inca were an empire, they loved gold. They loved diamonds. They didn't view it as money. They just viewed it as shiny bling. So the Spanish came, the mines were in operation, they just took them over and required the Inca people to go and do what the Spanish wanted. So you're going to go and you're going to mine and you're going to get wealth. Mina also was used to build roads, to build bridges. So you paid your tribute in the form of work, labor. The Spanish would also make money through foodstuffs, crops, as well as livestock. Because there was money to be made in animals and vegetables. Livestock, cows, horses, chickens, pigs, they were raised on small, multi-purposed farms, which were called haciendas. These were diverse in what they produced, because you just can't make horses. So typically they produced whatever food they needed to consume. One of the more interesting details of haciendas is natives typically were paid to work on haciendas. So if you went and worked for the owner would give you food that was raised on the farm, would give you some type of clothing based on whatever material they raised on the farm. So they were paid for their service. And they typically lived there. So many haciendas would eventually grow and would become towns that exist today, all the way as far as California. But there would also be farming entities that would produce single crops, cash crops, not for consumption, but the whole purpose was to produce this crop in mass, harvest it, put it on a boat, ship it across the Atlantic. Plantations. Sugar, coffee, tobacco, cotton, all big. Cash crops. But the problem was, labor on the plantations was filled by the MITA system. So laborers were not going to get paid. Laborers would not get housing. Laborers would just have to work because that was what expected to them. And particularly when you had the outbreaks of disease, finding workers for the plantation was hard. So the Spanish decided to exploit the contacts that the Portuguese had made. You with me so far? So to get laborers to work on their plantations, the Spanish decided the natives were not good enough, so they had to look elsewhere. And this would give rise to what today we call the transatlantic slave trade. Now, on slavery. Slavery is the oldest institution in recorded human civilization. Some of the oldest cuneiform tablets unearthed in Mesopotamia give references to headcounts of slaves. Slavery has been practiced everywhere on earth. Every race has owned slaves. Every race has been enslaved. And here's proof. The word slave is referenced to Slav, which were the white people taken by the Mongolians and sold to the Europeans after the Black Death. The weirdest thing, I have Slavic. I have ancestry that was once a Slav, a slave, that was owned by one of my other relatives, a German-Austrian. So at one point, my ancestors owned my other ancestors. Go figure.
And the same is probably true with all of you if you're able to dig back far enough. Because slavery, up until the 18th century, never had any stigma to it. It was never morally wrong or abhorrent. It was just a form of business. And even worse, there were many ancient philosophers that said it was justified, that it was natural.
None other than Aristotle himself once basically said that there are certain people that are meant to be enslaved, and there are certain people meant to use their labor. So it was never seen as a big deal.
So there's one misconception that we need to wash away. Misconception number two. The white guys didn't land and take the Africans. And the white guys didn't start it. Using African slaves actually was started by the Muslims back in the 7th century. So by the time the Portuguese arrived in the 15th century, for 800 years, Muslim caravans crossed across North Africa and they came in contact with some of those powerful African chieftains that I talked about. And the Muslims traded with the African chieftains. Because guess what the African chieftains were doing? To get more, 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 they were going to war with their neighboring tribes and conquering them and taking their land and taking their women. But they had a surplus of these captured people. So they traded them. Most slavery in history has come from conquests, military conquests. So the Africans weren't doing anything different than anyone had ever done before. And by the way, Islam not only allows slavery, it encourages slavery of non-Muslims. Because Islam does not view non-Muslims favorably unless you're a person of the book. So Muhammad gives reference to Christians and Jews, but pagans? They're to be destroyed, eradicated, and whatnot. So for the Muslims, it was no big deal. And as I said, the only why this was possible was because the Africans themselves were involved. Because let's be honest. Do you think a boat of white guys could penetrate a continent and actually take over an entire village, conquer them, arrest them, seize them, and not die? It just didn't happen. The Europeans would go to the trading posts that were built by the African chieftains, and they would bring with them stuff of value. And how much would they get out of it? Well, modern estimates suggest that somewhere between 10 to 12 million people were bought from the African merchants and sailed across the Atlantic Ocean to work for the benefit of the European economies. And what they gave changed over time, because this lasted for hundreds of years. Gold dust, glass beads, alcohol, firearms, gold, silver. The Europeans brought to the Africans whatever they wanted.
If the Africans wanted cotton, wool, whatever, the Europeans got it because that's what they used to trade or buy, if you want to think of it in that sense. And it wasn't just one part that was involved. Look, almost the entire coast of Africa was involved, almost the entire continent. Because the Africans everywhere, the African chieftains, were doing the same thing the Europeans were doing. War, more, more, more. So, while it started in sub-Sahara Africa, eventually it would spread down and most of them would come from West Africa. And, if you'll notice, the largest percentage of slaves went to Brazil, which would become a Portuguese colony, as well as to the Caribbean. It's one of the reasons why if you ever meet a Dominican or a Haitian, they don't look like Mexicans. Because the slaves that brought over largely replaced all of the populations that were originally there before the Spanish came. Oh, and by the way, notice, our country, because we've destroyed our history, gets a lot of crap for slavery. Only a small percentage came here. Only a small percentage. About 3.5%. And by the way, they were brought here before the United States existed. We were actually British colonies. And it wasn't just the Spanish or the Portuguese that were involved. Nope, 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 nope. First it was the Portuguese, then the Spanish would take it over, then the Dutch would take it over, then the English would take it over, and the French. Everyone played a role. Because again, it had nothing to do with morality. It was just business. It was just business. Of course, we have to remember that all this was made possible because of the Portuguese. Prince Henry sending those expeditions. Some of the Portuguese brought back some slaves, if we want to call them slaves, but they didn't know what to do with them in Portugal. Because the Portuguese had enough peasants. But to ensure that they were doing nothing wrong, Prince Henry's brother, Alfonso V, when he became king, he actually sent a question to the Pope to see if taking these Africans were wrong. Africans that were being offered to them by other Africans. And Pope Nicholas V, he responded, using the same justification going back to the Crusades. Saracens, pagans, and any unbelievers can be reduced to property status. Now, I will note that the church changed its position 80 years later. But by then, the new world was being conquered, these plantations were being created, and nobody listened. We're going to finish because I'm almost done. This is redundant. Talked about this already. They weren't taken. They were bought or traded for. And it was the Africans themselves that did the collecting. And the slaves initially, we talked about that. Most of them went to the Portuguese and the Spanish colonies. And they were brought in to fill the labor. But unlike the natives, who were not enslaved, these people were allowed to be owned. Because the Pope said so. Chattel is reference to property. So in the eyes of the plantation owners, they weren't human beings. They were tools to make money. And because our time is up, I got one last click. Why did they take the Africans? Well, this goes back to the point that I made, one of the reasons why the natives just were rolled over. Because the Africans were part of the Eurasian African landmass. The Africans had been exposed to all of the diseases that killed the natives. So unlike a native comes in contact with the Spanish guy and the next thing you know, next week he's dead, you can take the Africans, you can bring them over here, and they're not going to die of disease. Oh, and one other point. If a native runs away from a plantation, he can disappear. What's going to happen if an African runs away from a plantation? Where's he going to go? Is he going to swim home? And chances are his home isn't even there anymore because his village was conquered and wiped out by another African chief.
History, my friends. History, my friends, is what it is. So I will leave you with one happy thought, seeing how we're done for the week. Just be thankful you live in 2024 in these United States of America, and we figured out that this does not work. We've learned from the mistakes, and we don't have it anymore. So. All right, we're going to come back, and we're going to see what the Portuguese did. Then we're going to see, learn a little bit about the Asian trade network. And then we're possibly going to do what England did. And then we're going to have our next exam. So I'm shooting for opening the exam after next Thursday's class. So what I will do is I will probably open it like Thursday night, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I'll give you a whole bunch of days. Because I don't want to wait a whole week and then give you the test on Monday when we come back from spring break. I'd rather have us just get it done, then we can start fresh when we come back. All right? Just want to give you the heads up on that. So, if you missed any classes, get the notes. Start studying now.